So the receiver on Voyager is probably running something like 20 hertz of bandwidth to get a good enough signal to noise ratio on that data rate on the uplink. That's a guess as to what I think is going on here, Bull. WS2F, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, that's very good. This way he'll have plenty of information. I think he should also copy the website voyager.jpl.nasa.gov. You know, the website's been up for forever. It probably will be up for another 20 years, too. So you go to that, and they'll tell you everything you want to know about the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 spacecraft. And they have a constant clock going by on mileage, on kilometers and mileage, and astronomical units. It tells you it's 134 AU from the sun. That's for Voyager 1, 110 for Voyager 2. And, I mean, things like, you know, Voyager 2 was launched before Voyager 1. Why did they call that Voyager 1? Because they knew Voyager 1 was going to get to the outer planet before. It had a faster trajectory. A lot of cool info on that website. You can look up the spacecraft and the RTG on there, and you know how many watts it puts out. Okay, Dick, I'll give you a space report if you like. This is WS2N.
Fire away, Paul. You sound good.
Yeah, I turned my antenna. I didn't turn it back far enough. I was speaking to Connecticut the other day. Last week we had a launch of the Cygnus spacecraft, launched from Florida on an Atlas V rocket. And the spacecraft, the idea of the Cygnus spacecraft is to go up to the International Space Station, bring up almost 8,000 pounds worth of supplies, food, clothes, EVA equipment, a lot of things on there. It's got the nano racks for deploying CubeSats. It's got the new Made in Space, that's the name of the company, Made in Space 3D printer. One up there now. This is a more updated version. They're getting better at that, doing that, creating tools, and able to make things actually up in space. This is upgraded. You'll be able to put different materials in to make things. They have the Sapphire experiment. That's the one that's attached to Cygnus. We talked about that, I believe, last week. The experiment where they're going to when the Cygnus starts to deorbit a couple of months from now, after it's unloaded and they load it up with trash, they normally have it burn up over the Pacific Ocean. In this case, they're gonna let it fly for a couple of days instead of 2 days deorbit or a day in deorbit. They'll leave it in orbit for about 8 days, and they're gonna run some tests inside the spacecraft, lighting fires, and seeing how it burns. They need to get some information on fire prevention for future missions. So I thought that was pretty good. They have a meteor camera on board that they plan on taking pictures of meteors down below. You know, we look up into the sky to see meteors. They look down, and there's going to be a lot of video taken of these meteors, including they have a spectrometer attached to it, so it'll be able to tell what it's made out of with this meteor experiment. They're going to attach this to the American Destiny module. There's a little port, glass port on the bottom. You want to call it the bottom, let's call it the floor. And it's going to be indoors, so they don't have to do any EVAs. They'll be able to attach this meteor camera thing to the floor and take a tremendous amount of video. So much video that it's too much to transmit even through the teacher satellites. So what they're going to do is also install part of this gadget, this media camera thing, is going to be a little over 30 hard drives. So instead of just sending the pictures directly down through the space station, they're going to load up these hard drives, and next time the SpaceX goes up to get the camera in the future, you'll be able to send it down on Dream Chaser. That'll be another spacecraft that'll be able to land and bring stuff, supplies, and experiments back from the International Space Station. So all this is coming up. Right now, Dragon can do it, and that's the only one that's capable of bringing scientific stuff back, and it does. Let me drop it. And it does that on a regular basis, of course. So, with the CubeSats going up and everything, it should be a good mission. It was docked up to the space station on Saturday. That went flawlessly. What didn't go flawlessly was the launch of the Atlas V. Atlas V has a terrific record. They've launched over 100 of these things, the United Launch Alliance, and pretty much almost 100% success. This time was, let's call it 99%. I watched the rocket take off. It was 11:30 Tuesday night. So I saw it take off on the NASA TV on the computer. And the first stage, they run a RD-180. It's a Russian-built rocket. Shut down about 5 seconds early. I didn't notice that. But what I did notice, looking at the second stage, they have the RL-10 that's made by Aerojet. That's the second stage. First stage is RP-1. That's kerosene and oxygen. And the second stage is made by Aerojet. And that's liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. And watching this thing, and it's going on and on. When's this thing going to run out of fuel? You know, it had to run about, 8 to 10 minutes. Let's drop it. And then finally it shut off, and they said, the Cygnus spacecraft got into proper orbit. It opened up, it's got new solar cells. They tried the new fan types of solar panels. Last flight and this flight as well, they opened up, everything worked great. This is what they call the enhanced Cygnus spacecraft. About one-third longer than the original one. And this flight and the last flight were the first time they used this. They can carry more volume, heavier loads. But then a report came out about a day or two later, and they did say that the booster shut down about 5 seconds earlier. And, the computers and everything on board tell the second stage, if something happens, to fire for a longer period of time. Sure enough, the report did come out. And it worked out, but, within seconds, they figured out that the fuel on board was very minimal when they were done. They knew they had enough fuel on board in case there was a delay in the launch. So, they had a half-hour window. But if that happens, the fuel is used to change the inclination a little bit, because the Earth is getting out of proper inclination if you let time go by too long. So the Cygnus, the Centaur, they actually call it the Centaur, the RL-10 rocket built by Aerojet, applied for a longer period of time to correct not only the speed, but for altitude and for slight inclination change. Now, the Atlas is, you know, it's heavy duty. They have plenty of fuel on board normally. But because of this change of shutdown that occurred early, they needed to compensate for that. Now, the reason it's important now is it's an unmanned flight, but in the future, Atlas V will be manned flight. So that's what's coming up. It's going to run a very similar setup. I think the only difference is they're going to run two solids off of the side of the Atlas V rocket. But it's going to be a similar configuration with the RL-10 engine for the Centaur, and they might have two of them. So, but the rocket will basically be the same, the Atlas V. So they're looking into what caused this problem. And they do have a flight coming up actually next month, the MUOS 5 flight. That's a mobile user objective system. It's a flight that the Navy needs for communications. And that's actually going to be delayed a little bit until they look into what causes anomaly, make sure that it doesn't happen on future flights. So that was pretty good. There's more flights coming up this week at the end of the month, March 31st. You have another Progress ship going up. That'll be docked to the International Space Station, and that'll be on the Russian side. There's four ports over there available for docking. They're having one leave now, and this will replace that and dock to the module on the Russian side. And a few days after that, you got another one, SpaceX, going up with the Dragon spacecraft. But that one I'm going to be interested in, because not only are they going to bring supplies up, I've mentioned this many times before, they're bringing the Dean Bigelow expandable activity module up, and that's the one that weighs about 3,000 pounds, so it's relatively light. But this thing will be attached to the International Space Station, the Tranquility Node. And then after it's installed, the crew on board is going to inflate it. And it's going to, like, almost triple in size. So that I'm really looking forward to. It'll be attached to the space station and stay there for a couple of years. If it works out, NASA will be able to use that technology, or maybe even private companies will use that technology to actually have connecting pieces with, like this beam. You could build a space station out of it. It's a lot lighter to launch, and they say it's quite durable. Let me drop it. And I could go on, Dick, but maybe I'll stop. I know you got a nice Russian flight. I can see the Russians go up. It's our competition that really gets us going. And they built a brand new launch facility in their eastern part of the country, way eastern part, thousands of miles away from Moscow, thousands of miles away from where they launch now, Kazakhstan, or Plyetsk. Plyetsk is the northern one. This is called Vostochny. And they spent billions of dollars on this thing. And it's naturally behind schedule. But their first launch is coming up at the end of April. They're going to launch a Soyuz spacecraft and that. That's pretty good. But, I've mentioned it before. A lot of countries are involved. China's involved. And now you even have the United Arab Emirates. Arab country. They're building a spacecraft. And they just signed on with Japan. They're going to have the H-2A launch a spacecraft to Mars. They want to put one into orbit. So, a lot going on, Dick. Any questions, comments? And anybody have any questions or comments directly for me, I could always be reached at WS2N@ARRL.net. Dick, over to you.
Question for Paul? That's what I was about to ask for. Anybody got any questions? John's the first. Go ahead, John.
they have expectations of using those inflatable modules that they're sending up. Is that basically the design they're working on to place them maybe on Mars or the Moon to make habitable zones? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, that's Bigelow. He's really going full blast with this. In fact, it's supposed to be a news conference with him coming up in probably a couple of days, discussing the beam. Beam is the first one that's actually going to have people in it. He's launched two other smaller versions of it, actually by a Russian proton rocket called Genesis 1, Genesis 2. And they're actually still in orbit and still inflated. And they could still get telemetry down from it. And that was launched back in 2007. So they're coming a long way with the with these modules they have. Now, this is relatively small. This one is like 10. When it's expanded, it's only like a small living room, 10 foot by 13 foot room. Let's see, 13 feet in diameter, 10 feet deep. These bigger ones, they call them the 330. 330 stands for 330 cubic meters. Very large spheres that he plans on eventually putting up when they drop it into orbit. Like you said, John, he's got plans on sending these things to the moon. He wants to have inflatable living quarters on the moon. Of course, that would be a long way off. He has to prove the technology out, and then, of course, eventually on Mars. But in the short term, if you can get an approval on this one, and again, that will take 2 years. He's already got these things built, and if you went to Las Vegas and you went to his plant, he's got this thing set up, the 330, and you could fit comfortably six astronauts in this, and then you put two together, or you could put as many as you want together, and he wants to build an orbiting space station. Boeing and SpaceX and even Sierra Nevada with the Dream Chaser are actually banking that this guy's going to build his space stations. And he wants to build multiple space stations because they plan on using these spacecraft that they're building for NASA, the Starliner and SpaceX Dragon crew, to not only go to the International Space Station. They want to be able to fly to the Bigelow Space Station. It's a goal of Bigelow to have tourists go up, scientists, on a regular basis back and forth to the inflatable space station. So that's the story on that. And, they had a... I forgot her name. She was the deputy NASA administrator. She went down to Las Vegas and got a tour of this place, and they threw a video on it. And it's an incredible structure that they're building. He even has long-term plans of the 2100 cubic meter version, which is, it's just huge. He's going to need big platform to get this off the Earth. He's got plans with Elon Musk to use the Falcon Heavy, that's the three Falcon 9s strapped together, to launch these space inflatable modular living quarters into space. Back to you, John.
Did you cue QIQ with a question?
Very good, Paul. All right, Glenn, pick it up, sir.
Yeah, Paul, actually, this one's questions for you. I was just wondering, is there any research and development for, space program, rocketry, special vehicles that are being developed here on Long Island that you're aware of? Case 2 QIQ.
Now, the last one that I heard was that hyperspace one that was the X-40 Debris, I think it was. And that was attached to the front end of a Pegasus rocket built by Orbital Science. And it was actually they used the, name of that aircraft? I forget the name of the aircraft. They took it up and then they drop it. Was an R-1011. They dropped it from the craft, and an orbital rocket pushed it, I think it was a scramjet engine, and that thing was built somewhere not too far from me. I don't know if it was the plans or the actual building of it. There was a company very close to MacArthur that built this X-40. I think it's the X-43. Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Paul. Thanks for the update. Yeah, I was just wondering if there was anything like around the Grumman area or anything like that in Bethpage. Because interestingly enough, there's been some really, really interesting sightings of things in the sky around here lately, especially as people of Belmore. That a lot of the neighborhood, it's actually crazy stuff that we're even starting to see websites popping up about strange lights in the sky over here. And it's been kind of, we saw stuff like this a few years back, and now it's getting pretty heavy-duty. It seems to always be between the ocean and around the Grumman facility. That's why I was wondering if there's anything that anybody knew of that's going on right here, but there's nothing like in the news or anything about it. I'm going to pass back to you, Paul, KC2QIQ.
I know any of the testing and everything years ago used to go by, you know, you'd have to go out to Calvert, and, you know, they would have, Bethpage was assembly and everything, and they put pieces together, but the final, like when they built the F-14s, they would all be completed out in Calvert, and you could go out there and watch them fly all day long, and just watch them take off and go straight up in the air when I was working out there. As far as, I don't know, I think ever since working out Grumman left here after the LEM was built, all the F-14s, they stopped making them. I don't think there's been anybody to pick up the pace on Long Island, which is a shame, you know. But I know there's a lot of companies making parts, you know, camera parts and things that wind up on a Mars rover and things like that, but nothing big, nothing flying that I know of. Think over to you.
Paul, when it comes to the inflatable modules, I think it's Elon Musk that's building them for the International Space Station. I'm not sure, but I don't think one of them has been put into orbit yet. You're going to correct me on that. And my next question is, what's the major advantage of an inflatable module? For the same volume, is it lighter than a non-inflatable? Question number one. Can you ship it up there in collapsed form and then inflate it when it's there as a way of shipping more volume more astronaut volume when it's inflated and installed at the International Space Station? But now shipping it would be a lot easier if you could ship it uninflated. So what's the advantage? Is it really lighter? Is it cheaper? Is it believed to be more reliable, and so on? Give me some words on that, Paul. WS2N, with the second half of the space report, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, Bigelow is building them. Elon Musk, I'm sure, will be one of the companies that sign on to launch these things, with his Falcon 9. But, Bigelow, he's been building. He got the contract signed off years ago. What happened was, I don't know if you remember a project probably 40 years ago called Dinosaur. Dinosaur was going to be a space plane put on top of a rocket, and NASA did a lot of work with it, tested it out, and then eventually stopped spending money on it. You had a lot of money being poured into different programs. One of the programs NASA was putting money into was a habitat that could, I'm trying to make the connection. Dinosaur was, it gets turned over to another company. In this case, it was turned over to Sierra Nevada. And now they're building the Dream Chaser. Well, NASA also built other things, they were spent a lot of money on a deflatable habitat system. And when they dropped that, it got, I guess, too costly. They didn't want to work with it anymore. This guy Bigelow bought up the plans, let's call it, the legal rights to it. And he's been doing it ever since the year 2000. And here it is, 16 years later. And now he's actually building one of these things that people can go in. He's flown two already. I mentioned before, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. They're small. I think they were about 10 feet long or something. And he launched them on approach.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
He launched them on a proton rocket from Russia called Genesis 1, Genesis 2. Still in orbit today. And they were inflatable. Now, the beam, of course, now is a small version of what he really wants to build, the 330. The beam is only 3,000 pounds. When it's if you were to send up a steel, an aluminum tin can, like one of the modules that are on the space station now, something of a comparable size, it would probably weigh, maybe three times that weight. Now, this thing could also expand. It's got to be sent up. Very, very small, and I think it's only like 6 feet long, when it's being, it's actually stuck in the back of, they call it the trunk of the Dragon spacecraft, and then it's maybe 7-8 feet in diameter right now. You blow it up, it's got to be 12 feet long, and it's got to be, 11 feet in diameter, so, it'll be attached, it has a door on it, they'll be able to go in there, set up sensors and everything, they'll actually set it up when it's attached, and then they'll leave, close the door, and intermittently go back and forth. That's the way it's going to work for 2 years. Back to you, Dick.
These inflatable modules that have already been launched, one or two of them in space, sounds like they were not yet linked up to the International Space Station. They're in their own orbit, so to speak. What's going to make them stay in that orbit? Are they going to be boosted periodically? Have they ever been occupied by a human being, even with a spacesuit? Putting them in space is putting them under working conditions, so to speak, but if they're just sitting there inflated in space and slowly decaying, what eventually is going to happen? How they're going to be deorbited? I presume, like you said, their advantage is that they're like one third the weight of a similar aluminum module of the same volume. That's the advantage. And I'm not quite sure now. Do they get inflated after they're launched, or are they always inflated first before launch? Could they be shipped uninflated? And has anyone ever worried about the failure mechanism if you hit an inflated one with a small meteorite, as opposed to hitting an ordinary module with a small meteorite? Has anyone done an analysis saying that the damage would be very similar and the repair procedure would be equally as easy? Open you for any of that information, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in effect, man.
Yeah, Bigelow sent these first two up, Genesis 1, Genesis 2. Unmanned, very small. I think they're only about 10 feet or 8 feet long or something. He just wanted to see if they would inflate and stay that way. And he did have sensors and everything inside that transmitted information. In fact, he had cameras inside, cameras outside. In fact, I think there's a website you can go to and see the transmissions. That I don't think they're going on, but I think as far as a year or two ago, they were still transmitting. It's probably a high enough altitude. It was launched by a proton rocket. I mean, proton rockets are heavy lift vehicle in Russia. So I think it probably was a secondary payload. So I don't know how high it's up. I think it's up there pretty high. It's not going to deorbit anytime soon. So of course it wasn't really meant for people. He just wanted to check the concept to see if it would work. And that was back in 2007. So he knows it worked. And now he wants to see if this will work. The beam, it is collapsed now. It's like I said, it's about a little less than 8 feet in diameter, probably 7.5 feet in diameter. And it's only about 6 feet long right now. So, you can see somebody standing next to it when they were getting ready to put it into the back of the Dragon spacecraft, into the trunk. So, we'll see a lot about it on April 8th.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We'll see a lot about it when this beam gets launched on April 8th. And, after it's attached to the space station, then it's actually got its own tanks. You're not going to take air from the space station to inflate this thing. It's got its own, nitrogen charge, whatever they're going to use to inflate this. And the astronauts will, they'll throw the switch on that, and then it'll just blow up. I hope it don't blow up, but you know what I mean. It'll blow out into the shape of looks like a spear to me. It'll be attached to the Tranquility module on the aft side, facing backwards. So, plenty of room. You've got all these docking ports now. You got four with the Russians. Now we'll have four with the on the American side. And two of those docking ports are now going to be occupied. Right now, one is already is now occupied by another Cygnus spacecraft attached to Unity, and then this thing going up April 8th will be attached to the Harmony module, and robot arm will reach around, grab a hold of this thing from the trunk, and bring it all the way over to its home on the Tranquility module. Back to you, then.
Does the International Space Station run at 14.7 pounds per square inch? That sounds like these inflatable modules. If so, will operate at the same pressure. I presume there is no airlock on this thing. In other words, the space station has to supply that function. So therefore, the one that's in space right now, if it doesn't have an airlock, there might not be a way that an astronaut could climb in there to see what it's like when you're on the inside, when it's in space. So give me some words on that, Paul. Does it run at full pressure? Does it have an airlock? And are there plans for adding those kind of functions at a later time? WS2N, K2RIW.
No airlock. There's two doors. You have a door on the space station side, inside the Tranquility module, 53 inches wide, and that opens up like a garage door on two tracks. Pulls toward you, and then it right raises up. And then the astronauts will be looking at the other door, and it's the same type of door that they just opened up, except it's on their side. And the only difference is they're able to open it from the inside of the space station. They crank it, and latches, dog type of latches, all on, disconnect, looks like about eight of them. And then they push the door and then raise the door. And now they're inside the beam module. At that point, they'll be able to set up all kinds of indicators, meters, check for radiation coming through the walls, check for any micrometeorites that might impact the outer skin of this thing. And they're going to check the integrity of it. They're going to close the doors after they're done, and they'll be able to, you know, monitor what's going on in there. In case there's any kind of, you know, deflation going on, they'll know it. And but intermittently, they're going to open the door and they're going to hang out in there. They said it's going to be very quiet. No fans or anything blowing. the rest of the space station is very noisy. And to answer your question about the pressure, SS and the beam will be 14.7 pounds per square inch. They're breathing oxygen and nitrogen back here. No argon.
In other words, normal Earth-like conditions. You said the word argon. Do any of the spacesuits, spacecraft, whatever, use argon? I wonder why you mentioned the word argon now, Paul. Go ahead.
I only mention that because on Earth we have, what, 21% oxygen and nitrogen. But there's always like that 1% of argon, you know, they always say the 1% of argon and other minimal gases that you don't have. You have your nitrogen and your oxygen. That's why I just made the comment at the end. No argon.
That makes sense. None of the trace gases, which are not required that we know of. Now, when you make an inflatable larger in diameter, you have the so-called Laplace equation problem, very similar to what goes on with tires. The small cross-sectional area tire of an English racing bike, you inflate that to 70 pounds. The fat bicycle tire that you use on an American bike, inflate that to 28 pounds. And the tire you put on your automobile, which is holding close to 1,000 pounds per wheel, you inflate that to 24 pounds again. So, as you make something larger in diameter, the same amount of air pressure makes a tremendous improvement and a tremendous increase in surface tension. Let me drop it. And I think the number, if it was a spherical object, I think the number is square law. You double the diameter, the same amount of air pressure, I think, gives you four times the amount of skin tension because of the inflation. That phenomenon, the so-called Laplace equation, is the reason why an aneurysm that happens into a human blood vessel, an artery, for instance, that develops an aneurysm, can become a runaway condition very fast. As it comes larger in diameter, the same amount of blood pressure makes more and more skin tension, which creates more and more inflation, and pretty soon you can have a burst. And a aortic aneurysm, an abdominal aortic aneurysm, is an extremely dangerous condition. A good friend of mine suddenly died of that one day with very little symptoms before it happened. So when they go to a larger diameter, they have to tolerate much more skin temperature or skin tension. It's inflatable. Does that mean it's made out of a rubberized fiberglass-like material? What do you think the actual material is? And is there multiple layers of that material? What kind of protection do you have from a micrometeorite hitting it, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, I'm still trying to learn how this thing is constructed. I've looked into it. It looks like Bigelow is not releasing all the information. I find it hard to believe that NASA doesn't know exactly what it's made out of. I understand it's very thick, probably, 8-inch thick walls, and many layers of, mylar and something similar to Kevlar is protecting it from micrometeorites. And they've done experiments. They have these cannons on Earth that you take this material, they run tests and shot little BBs into the side of this thing, and there's very minimal damage, and they claim there's less damage than this because it tends to absorb the shock better than you know, tin can fabrication that, you know, we always use for space stations and spacecraft. According to Bigelow, it's also better than typical space station material for radiation. He believes it's got higher radiation resistance toward anything going on out there. It's supposed to be very, and actually the heat problem is always there. Yeah, you see, you don't have any windows in this thing. You know, which means it's very hard to develop these things with ports. I mean, he does have a big port, you know, to get in and get out. So I'm sure they could, you know, devise windows in it. And he must have plans for that in the future. That means you would also need, you know, some kind of ports to actually have ammonia lines and everything connecting to heat exchanges. You know, eventually you're going to have, you know, a flying, you know, series of these things, a flying space station. You're going to have to be able to get rid of the heat. You've got to be able to have all these ports and windows that people look out of. So, but I understand he's worked on all these problems. By the way, the beam that is going to be attached, he plans on using as a future airlock on one of his space stations. He's actually got a purpose for this thing. We'll see. Bigelow. He owned, probably still does, a lot of hotels and motels around the country. And this is what he's been doing. And this has become his full-time job, from what I understand. He's really into developing this. Back to you, Dick.
Now, Paul, you just said a mouthful when you said the wall thickness is 8 inches. I was going to guess the wall thickness is something like 1 inch. 8 inches of wall thickness. Wow. I'm looking at 8 inches on a ruler right now. Boy, you could put a zillion layers of Kevlar and Mylar and Teflon and fiberglass and all kinds of stuff in 8 inches. Wow. Are you sure? My next question is a tin can module. How thick is the walls? Can't believe that's 8 inches of metal thickness, if you know what I mean. And this 8-inch thickness, you said that the inflatable module is 1/3 the weight. Well, maybe it's 1/3 the weight because it's 1/8 the volume, so maybe we're not making the right kind of comparison here. If I built a space inhabitable module ready for the International Space Station, let me drop it. And I made the walls 8 inches thick out of strong materials. Boy, that sounds like it's heavier. On top of that, if the walls are made out of 8-inch thick material, I can't fold that very much. I'm not going to be able to collapse that like you collapse a balloon to ship it, if you know what I mean. So now, how thick is the regular walls of a regular module, the metal, the tin can as you call it? And that's particularly interesting to ask about because you may know that on the lunar module made by Grumman, they had to fight every ounce everywhere. As such, the wall thicknesses of that habitable module on the lunar module were so thin, the astronauts were only half joking that they said if they kicked the wall, they would probably kick a hole in it. They worried a little bit if somebody had a nightmare and kicked violently enough, they could possibly kick a hole in the wall. So I'm guessing that the wall thickness on the lunar module is an extremely small fraction of what we're talking about here. So, do you know the wall thickness of an ordinary International Space Station module? And are you sure it's 8 inches? Wow. That surprises the hell out of me. WS2N, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm going back a couple of years ago when I was trying to remember this lady's name. She's the assistant NASA administrator. I think it was Lori something or other. I don't know. She was at the at their site and got a tour of it. And that's where I remember reading it was 8 inches thick. And the report is, when it's inflated, it's like concrete. You can't get through this stuff. That's the way it's described. They said it feels like it's as hard as concrete. That's the exact words. So, time will tell. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of information coming out. The exact thickness of the walls. Back a couple of years, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is. I'm not going to say positive. That's what I read about it probably in 2013 when they were really going full blast with this. They're way behind schedule. The launches, this should have happened a couple of years ago. So, and when they say they're going to inflate it, I'm thinking that what they're inflating it with is really the wall itself. I think it's being inflated. I just can't imagine that this thing is holding its shape from air pressure from 14.7 pounds. I think there's other gases, probably nitrogen, involved in the walls of this, but I don't know that yet. But that's what I really believe. I think it would hold its shape. Just
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I can't get enough details yet there, but we will.
I'm having trouble believing, Paul, that inflation goes on between the inner wall and the outer wall that's 8 inches thick. You don't get any advantage in inflating between the walls unless you want the wall to have a certain degree of torsional stiffness to it. If you want the wall to be unbendable, then yes, you would inflate between the two. But when it comes to holding in the internal air pressure, 14.7 pounds per square inch, I see no advantage in inflating between the walls. Make the wall as thick as required to hold back that pressure. Now, in the case of the 28 pounds per square inch that you and I put in our automobile tires, that creates an amount of skin tension. That's a huge number. If it wasn't for the metal belts, the metal cords, the steel cords that are in your tire, that tire would fail very rapidly because of skin tension. And that tire on your automobile, I don't know the exact number, but maybe it's got a cross-sectional diameter of 8 or 10 inches. And now you take something that is 10 feet in diameter, and 14.7 is half of 28, but still, 14.7 pounds per square inch, 10 feet in diameter. The amount of skin tension there is a very large number of thousands of pounds of skin tension. That's why it'll feel like concrete when you put your fist onto it, because of huge skin tension. This Laplace formula thing, as the diameter goes up, the same amount of air pressure creates a huge skin tension. Temperature, let me drop. You may know that a test was going on at an air base a couple of years ago, and I think it was a C-130, and they were testing whether or not the valves were working correctly. So a guy was on the ground pumping air pressure into that fuselage. I don't know the exact number, but I think he was supposed to pump in 2 pounds per square inch or something like that, above atmospheric pressure, and he read his gauge improperly. Instead of 2 pounds, he went to 20 pounds or something like that. But to make a long story short, he exploded the fuselage of a C-130. I think the airplane became a complete wipeout. So when you've got a large diameter, like the diameter of the skin of an aircraft, it doesn't take very much excess air pressure to create a skin tension that can easily create a rupture. And he did that with an amount of pressure that you and I could easily add with a bicycle pump, if you know what I mean, if you spent enough time. He wasn't adding very much air pressure. I think it only took a couple of extra pounds to create the explosion. So that, is there any way we can find out what is the thickness of the walls of a tin can module that's on the International Space Station right now? Whenever you see modules, the walls are just everywhere stacked with all kinds of stuff. And it looks like insulation also. So I don't think the astronauts can see the walls directly. I think it's covered up with various kinds of insulation. So I'd love to know the actual structural portion of that wall. What is it made out of and what is its thickness? There may not be information on that. That could be a tough one, isn't that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW.
I think it's, I'm going to guess around 4 inches. I've looked at it, and I tried to estimate. I've never seen a number on it. And I understand it's, you know, it's like a double. You know, you have a metal on the inside, metal on the outside. Somewhat of a, you know, a lot of mylar and stuff in between. And the biggest problem is getting rid of heat. So you have no heat transfer between the inner wall and the outer wall. So it's just like a spacesuit. You don't see much about heating coils or anything in a spacesuit, although they do have electric heating systems within the spacesuit. But the main problem is cooling. That's why they have hundreds of these tiny tubes all running through undergarments on your spaces. But these walls, I think they're standard walls. I'm gonna guess 4 inches just by looking at it. Although I don't know that. We'll see. One other thing I wanted to mention is the Boeing has now got the new white room built with their launch capability out at Launch Complex 41. They're doing good. We're going to have test flights probably by the end of the year, unmanned, that will eventually have manned flights in the beginning of 2017. So NASA just did a tour of the new white room that's going to eventually...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Space, which will eventually be going to the International Space Station. I did want to bring that up. First white room to be done in probably 50 years. Probably 40 years, probably. The last one was for the space shuttle.
That test facility 41, the new Boeing white room, what town and what state is that in, Paul? Is that at the... launch complex in California? I mean, in Florida?
Yeah, it's in Florida. It's right now, it's actually on the ground, but built. But eventually, we'd be hoisted up, and, you know, they'll install it at the top of the tower. That I'll be able to be pulled back right before launch, but that'll be the way they get into the in and out of the spacecraft. You know, they'll have their spacesuits on first, but, you know, maybe they'll put the helmets on in there. White room, it's all aluminum white walls. When I saw it, sprinkler systems all over on the inside and outside. I guess the sprinklers go up on the outside when the rocket is going up to try to keep everything cool. But Boeing's got it built. Eventually, SpaceX will have it for whatever rocket on 39A. You watch next year, we'll be talking about people launching from Florida.
One of the things you told us a couple of months ago, Paul, I'm pretty forgetful, I have to go pretty far back in my notes. The solar panels, you got a zillion acres of solar panels, per se, on the International Space Station. The total solar power capability of those solar panels, I think you told me it's something like 100 kilowatts. So run that by again. What is the capability of the solar panels in kilowatts? And I'm guessing they don't run at full power all the time. Maybe they only take 75% of that on the average day. So those solar panels on the average day are turning out how much, if you happen to know, and what's the peak power output in kilowatts. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
sun all the time, so sometimes they're down to zero. And they have these massive batteries. In fact, I'm going to be doing some battery change-outs. I think SpaceX is going to be bringing some big batteries up. They need some more batteries. And these are each section, you see four different main sections where these solar panels are. In the middle, they have these huge truss. Truss are probably about 14 feet, you know, side to side, in depth as they go out. And they run over the length of a football field. You know, where the center of all these groupings is where the solar panels come down. That's where they have these tremendous batteries. And that stores the power. And then discharges it when the panels are in dark. And that's about it. You know, I mean, they have the capability, and they did when the shuttles went up, to attach to the shuttles, essentially plugging the shuttles into the power system. They were able to get extended missions. And they'll be doing that they actually do it with Cygnus and future flights coming up with Dream Chaser. And you know, they're going to be docked to the space station for a couple hundred days sometimes. They have that capability. So they're going to need power. They'll be taking it from the solar panels. The space station has plenty of extra power to give. Back to you there.
Okay. So 128 kilowatts when it's in the sun. And because they're in orbit and almost half the time behind the Earth, they're getting almost zero some of the time. So 128, half of that is 64. So they're getting an average of 64 kilowatts if I average for a full orbit. 64 kilowatts of electrical power is coming out of those solar cells. That, in turn, is creating a very large number of BTUs of heat, because all of that electrical power is running some kind of equipment on the inside of the International Space Station. Almost none of that is moving, you know, lifting weights on the outside. Now, there's a little bit of power being used by the rotary joint that keeps the solar panels aimed in the right direction. But the majority of that, 128,000 watts, make believe you and I had electric burners on our electric range. Let me drop. Each burner on my electric range runs something like 3 kilowatts. So I could be powering something like 30 burners of my electric range. Now, no matter what that power is doing, whether it's moving transistors, it's moving an oscilloscope, and it's powering an exercise machine, whatever, all of it. Because the International Space Station is not creating any work to the outside universe. It's not doing anything to modify its orbit or whatever to the outside universe. All of that electrical power, after one, two, or three steps, becomes pure heat output inside of that living environment of the International Space Station. On top of that, each and every astronaut, 24 hours a day, because he's eating food and metabolizing, his body is generating 130 watts per human being. And six human beings, you got another kilowatt there. And that's small compared to the electrical input. So average of 64 kilowatts of heat is being generated by those solar cells making electricity, running things inside the living quarters. Therefore, they have to be able to dump something like 68 kilowatts of heat being converted into BTUs, if you like, the other system of units. So that cooling system, the cooling system has to approximately equal the amount of electrical power coming in. You see what I'm worried about here, Paul? That cooling system better be